Blog Talk Radio.
Sorry, I said that wrong. Jesus, try this again. Okay. Hello, welcome to Into the Darkness. I am Pam Ray. With me, as always, is my co-host, Intimidus Rex. Rex and I are poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to belong to the group or the website to call in, to share, to listen and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Also, make sure when you get a chance to check out our poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. Tonight's topic is twofold. First of all, we have carryovers from our Splatterpunk Dark Show, and then we have, after the carryovers, poetry inspired by Irish serial killers. So if you find that this show is a little too dark for you or it's not your cup of tea, please check out our other shows. We have a variety of shows, styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everybody's taste. And hello, Rex. How's it going?
All right. What's up?
Oh, not much. Just, you know, enjoying life. Looking forward to hanging out with you and other cool poets. We will have Victoria joining us a little later. And because, of course, she always hosts the Seriality Dark shows with us. You know, I have to say that, you know, it looks like we have a great lineup of poetry tonight, some great dark stuff. And, of course, you know, as people have probably picked up on, it'll be a little darker than our usual dark shows, which is saying quite a bit. And I had to just absolutely that intro song, because as everybody knows, that song Psycho Killer was originally put out by the Talking Heads. And I found this remake, and I looked up the name of the band because I couldn't remember what it was. It's Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. That is like one of the freakiest, coolest names I have ever heard of for a band. And cooking in your neck of the woods there.
Nothing.
Same old, same old. All right. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess I hope every title we have from here on out is only one word, because it might put a bit of a damper on your whole idea of answering every question with one word.
Yep.
So. All right. What do you have up for us first, Rex? And don't say
Cross the Clothing, Part 1, Bad Language, Loads of It, by Time Teller. Fucking roundabouts. Indicate, you bugger. Yeah. You're hard to read. Last night, the lady downstairs was crying. Her husband's a cunt. He bashes her and blames the drink. Bit like her across the landing. She berates her husband, screams at him all the dirty things he's supposed to have done, and of course, blames the drink. In the morning, she comes over, knocks my door sheepishly. Sorry for that last night. It was the drink talking. That's okay, I say. And after all, it is okay, because it's true. Yes, I'm the husband living next door, in peace, without the kids, and her in incessant nagging. I forgive her. The drink says some awful things. I'm sure she doesn't think them sober. And yes, Pete, that's sarcasm. And geez, stuck in traffic jam on the dual carriageway, incidentally on the very day the council meets decided to bypass is to go ahead. And here I am, stuck for an hour, because some idiot has crashed on the bridge, tried overtaking where it's single lanes, and coincidentally, again, causes maximum carnage to traffic lines. Fuck, I hate coincidences, especially contrived ones. Always seems like passive aggression when contrived. You know, like the overconfident but insecure really person who stands in the middle of a thoroughfare so as to be unavoidable in contact. You know this sort of thing, at weddings, parties, or wait to stay, you have no choice. No choice but to say hello and get involved. See? Passive aggression. Like the cunt overtaking half asleep at this time in the morning. I am sat here pondering. I wondered how many people would be open to having accepted a bribe to cause that crash on the very day the council meet to discuss it. Oh, shit. That's the traffic fumes talking. Turn the radio on, and Putin has shattered with Ukraine. And the West is talking like always. He's put his toes over the border, and words mean nothing, and action has never needed words, so we talk while he does. End poem.
Great read there, Rex. I really liked this write by Time Teller. I like how, you know, dark write, but it more focuses on the psychological darkness. I like that it's very relatable in that we've all been in those frustrating, traffic jams or, dealing with people going through roundabouts or, people with disobeying, traffic laws, and I like how it takes us into the mind of an individual person who's falling apart. It actually kind of reminds me a bit of that one movie about that guy who gets stuck in traffic and goes insane. I like that it's a first-person narrative, but we aren't really made aware that it is until in the middle, and with, yes, I'm the husband living next door in peace without the kids and her incessant nagging. I really particularly like that second to last stanza with the where he puts coincidences, and it's a wonderful play on words with the idea of, those incidences that happen, but also a coincidence. I found that, as I said, quite clever, and that idea of the coincidences, referring to such things as weddings, parties, wakes, those things where you have no choice but to get involved, the very passive aggressive nature of having to please other people. I also really liked how the ending brought us to the idea that, actions, and action has never needed words. So while we talk while he does, that's just really hard-hitting lines there that brings it into modern day. Just a wonderful thought-provoking dark light and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
It's a play on blame. I thought no matter what the issue is, someone always finds a reason to blame something else. Give you a drink. Could be the inhalation of fumes. It could be the fact that, did it because he felt like it. But it finds a reason why it occurs to begin with. And that's where the thought with the traffic jam being a nice bit there, somebody making a crash, and it pays somebody to do it just to make me late for an important council meeting, which is the usual. We find excuses to offset that which is happening so we can not take the blame for it. Maybe if I left 10 minutes earlier, I would now be sitting in the crash. I'd be ahead of it.
I like that, Rex. Great comment there. And I like the fact that you mentioned that it's all about that blame game that is played, finding someone else to blame for our own actions, our own choices. So great comment there. And what do you got for us next?
EMT by Casey Day.
Right. There it is. All right. The EMP by Casey Day, and it goes like this. There's not a lot that surprises me anymore, but something about seeing a man dangling from the ceiling held up by an extension cord wrapped around his throat sticks with me, makes me uneasy. I didn't know your name, but I held your daughter and carried her out of the room while investigators in the corner looked you up and down. She smiled at me and told me about what she was going to do that day, and I couldn't hear her words, but I smiled at her and pretended you weren't in the other room. I pretended because she was too small to deal with something so big, and you were so wrong to leave her alone, but it was too late. End poem. And your thoughts, Rex?
From that perspective, you get to see a whole lot. That's why that opening line holds itself the truth. There's not a lot that surprises me anymore. but the back end of reality, and one down and one living in the same moment where a death has occurred, and the other one too young to understand the consequences as well as the ramifications of that, kind of sets a tone for something different where you're making contact with the child, but you're not really making, because your mind's on the fact that you just saw her father hanging from the ceiling, and now you're dealing with the fact that she's small and she wants to talk, and that's kind of a little off-putting considering the nature of the reason why she's there in the first place.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you're right, I have to agree with you, that opening line really sets the tone, and it tells you a lot. And it tells you a lot about people who are in that line of work, the first responders, the EMTs, and the horrors that they see. And I think that second stanza, as you said, it's off-putting, but it adds the innocence of the child. The child just, you know, like you picture a child who's young, like, you know, 2 years old, at least I do, who doesn't quite register yet what death is. And they're just interested in talking about their day. You know, there's such an innocence within that second stanza that it makes the rest even darker. It really hits hard in that ending. Because, you know, the idea of just feeling for this child who has lost their father and is too small, too young to even yet comprehend what has happened. Just a powerful and emotive write, and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
The Mysterious Hand by Finn Heroy, this water. The Mysterious Hand. The sleuths are on roads and alleys, a posh neighborhood at Nottingham. Neighbors are carrying lump of fear in throats from jeweler to solicitors. Their front doors are stamped with a bloody hand impression. Eerie air, bolted homes, any insane killer or hijackers, or a naughty pranker. Kids have stopped going to school. House heads their office. Sniffer dogs have been brought down upon roads. Their sniffing duties ended up to a graveyard. Awestruck they got, bathed in sweat, a parted hand, blood fed, near the tomb. And poem.
Great read there, Rex. And a wonderful write by Sinharoy Dizwarup. I always feel bad that I don't quite know what is where his first name ends and where his last name begins. You know, I really liked this one on two levels. First of all, to me, it was just classic horror film element. You know, the bloody hand impression, you know, but also it really spoke to me on the idea of how quickly people can be set into a panic mode. You know, I really liked that with the second stanza. It's short, but it makes an impact with the whole idea of people bolting their homes and having that question, those theories going back and forth. Is it an insane killer, carjackers, or just a naughty pranker? So really just classic horror elements to it, and very well done. And your thoughts, Rex?
Oh, I bite on that, but there's another thought. Since everything seems to have the bloody hand impression, kind of hits on that notion from the Bible, the taking the firstborn in each household that didn't have the mark upon the door, so to speak.
Are you still there? Oh, you are. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, I just didn't it just cut off a little, but sorry. No, you know what? It's funny because I was going to mention that, you know, the Passover, the smearing of the blood lamb over the doorway so that, you know, that death would pass by that household. But I decided, well, you know, I'm not going to go that way. So I'm glad that you saw that and you brought it up because I think it was a really great observation. Definitely shows that this rite can be seen in multiple ways. So great comment there. And all right, what do we got next?
Not Yet Free by Nam Dag Somo.
All right, I'm guessing I'm reading this one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, and before I start to read this, if Victoria is listening, I would like to mention that this is our last carryover, and after this, we will be delving into seriality, Irish.
No, there's one more.
Oh, there's one more. Oh, okay. Never mind. One more after this. Okay, this is second to last. One more after this, and then Irish serial killers. Thank you, Rex. I should realize that. All right. And Not Yet Free by Nam Dag Somo, and it goes like this. A competition with a champion and an antagonist who is a clumsy person and motivated because no one will ever love them. Psychological trauma plagues their very existence. Our hero has turned bitter and cold in character, who may or may not succumb to melting, if not for his box of gears, on encountering an aristocratic widow. This person has imperial orders, which with elements including efficient minions, as well as a powerful secret society motivated by the rejection of the world. Examining social mores and morality, An androgynous female points the way to a country not yet free. Two people who seem to be able to only trust each other. Romance blossoms between them, kneeling in solitary prayer, and unresolved sexual tension between friends and enemies. Heroic gestures and emotional damage. The lover is revealed to be subhuman. There is a maelstrom, as a spirit guide needs swirling spirals of liquid emotion, ending with a hug and poem. Well, that is certainly a very intriguing rite that I found captivating. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, that picture reminds me of that Pirates of the Caribbean movie, I forget which one, with the maelstrom. And it hits on that with that first stanza, competition with a champion and an antagonist who is a clumsy person and motivated because no one will ever love them. Psychological trauma plagues their very existence. Well, that kind of hits on the notion of someone outside the realm of most people considers themselves wholly unlike, I guess. You know, bitter and cold in character. The sort of meeting that which you are not and finding there is something that might be there in the first place, and what once was maybe antagonist and protagonist now become friends, or at least frenemies, so to speak. There's a kind of a meeting of the minds. And then that hits on the sort of being able to actually sit at the table and discuss that which differs from them so they can come to some common ground, which kind of hits on that that notion of ending with a hug. You can't hold what once was you and what was held to you as something that you can hold up against everybody else.
I like that. Yeah, the whole idea of meeting something or someone that you didn't expect to meet, whether it's on the outside or even, you know, like you said, within yourself, or at least that's how I interpret what you said, You know, I like that this starts out with a competition with the whole first stanza, the very idea of someone plagued by psychological trauma, and they're feeling like their whole existence is part of that. I like how this has a very science fiction feel to it, and yet it also has a very almost like an idea of a spirituality of reaching out into the universe and finding something there. It kind of reminds me. I mean, I don't know why, but as I was reading this, you know, and or listening to your comment, I started thinking about this short story that was written like many years ago about that I read back in high school. That was about a kid who met an alien, but the alien was like made of the same substance as like sugar, and so when it started to rain, the alien melted. But before the alien melted, the alien kid had or I can't remember if it was a kid, but it was a younger person, had this conversation. This, and there was a great sense of loss felt by the human character in the short story, even though they hadn't known each other even for a full day. There's that kind of sense of that deeper connection of both emotional and physical. So just a really wonderful write all the way through, and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
Bloody Atlanta by Confess. Nature's sickening trails dragged my memory. White crystals laid in seven lines. My nostrils took a dive ruthlessly against this never-ending nightmare. Fleshy souls gathered around, bringing broken bones out of their closet, showing with pride. Colors melting together like waves of LSD. No one saw them. They were invisible. They disappeared in the urging night. Dreary fellows and femmes, astounded by daunting beauties, minced more lines and gathered bigger bones. The gloomy frozen tiles, with icy slithering lines, slayed bodies flung in pungent aromas. Seconds fleeting, melting into the grooves of music, tequila poured and whiskey spilled unto the wooden groves, my bloody nose spurted. Scrounging for silk and cotton, rough, but soft, menacing, infused with little rosy splotches, gathered unto the sands of snowy powder. Purity speaks to no one in the gusted smoked room. Menthol and a skunky stench lingered around me, savaged my lungs. Blinking bloodshed pupils as sweat trickles in between the crevices of two weighted mammary glands, searching for a liberated throne. Demoralized conclusions bear my soul. An aged horizon and a fruitless twang pesters my ears. Too soon to have escaped the pitiful surrounding. My resilient legs continue to sway, yet my limbs gathered like straws, unaroused. Unprepared in this unwelcoming secret, lose yourself. The voice afar brushed my temporal lobes, starting as a whisper, but as it expires, settle into an eerie cry. Transfixed by taunting spirits, they noosed my soul. Memories faded into desperate energy, roused by powder that sunk into the liquid. As the clock spun an entire round, my eyes remained seen and my heart continued to race. No pill could be chased, no sleep could be witnessed. Wicked laughs and husky arms strangled me, wishing my time there wouldn't end, but I, bewitched, I settled for an unnerving journey as the dawning sun rose. And poem.
Great read there, Rex. Wonderful write by Confess. I feel like this is one that you could relate to more than I can, but I'll go ahead and comment first because, you know, you just did that long read. I haven't heard from Confess in a while. I'm hoping sometime she starts calling back in again. She wrote actually on a true event that happened in her life, and I really felt like this was an excellent dark write and with powerful and visceral imagery, and that it had, there was this idea of mayhem and horror, that everything, all the sights and sounds and the way things move and even the lights and the way the mind twists after inhaling those white crystals laid in seven lines. I mean, right away, that first stanza really sets the tone. I really like scrounging for silk and cotton, rough but soft, menacing, infused little rosy splotches gathered under the sands of snowy powder. Purity speaks to no one in the gusted smoke roam. Menthol and skunky stench lingered round me, savaged my lungs. To me, she really takes us into this night. I also like transfixed by taunting spirits. They noosed my soul, memories faded into despair, energy roused by powders that sunk into the liquid as the clock spun an entire round. It just feels like there's a real sense of a heavy, that time passing simultaneously, both fast and slow. Just a powerful and intriguing write, and I really like how, as I said, she brought us into this so deeply, and very well done. And your thoughts, Rex?
Well, it does walk as a memory. The seven lines up front, the crystal already hit the notion of cocaine, so that's not a problem. My gather, between considering that third stanza opens up, colors melt together like waves of LSD, and it hits on a notion that it's a pretty high-volume mix. So that lends itself to the arena itself. Then minced more lines and gathered bigger bones. There's another thought to the rising temperament of those who feel powerful in the moment. And the description, everything else, the pungent aromas, the grooves of music, tequila and whiskey, and then the nose spurt. Not something that one likes in the moment, but it gives a nice little touch of color, especially with the little rosy splotches and the soft and rough cotton sprinkling onto the smelly powder. Nice touch with that. And then the thought of a menthol and skunky stench savaged my lungs. So it's a whole lot. This is a big party room, this one is. And then that note of the heartbeat racing and the blood, the sweat running between breasts in the moment. And let's see. Then paranoia kind of sits in. Demoralized conclusions bear my soul. Unprepared, this unwelcoming secret. Lose yourself. And there's that notion of wanting to forget something. The daunting spirits, they noosed my soul and hit on being sunk into the moment itself. That note in the bottom end is not wanting to leave, but knowing you will, because the sun is coming up and there is a need for sleep after such a long, easy night. Well, not an easy night, considering all the paranoia that went with it. A long night of partying.
Absolutely. And you're right. There is that. It definitely gives that idea at the end of needing that sleep after a long night. And I like that you mentioned the paranoia that came with it. Just an excellent comment there, Rex. Now, before we head on to the next poem, still just a tiny bit of time, so while we're in the middle of the show and probably have people listening, or we'll have people listening to the recorded version, why don't you tell us about your contest you have running for Sunday's show? Because I know you're needing some rights for that.
Yeah. It's poetry and the lyrics. I put up a song which I haven't given a title to. It's the lyrics from that song. And you ought to actually write into the lyrics. You can take a part, a piece, a sentence, a stanza, or the whole thing. It doesn't matter. And weave out what comes with that that thought in the reading.
Very cool. Is the title a secret for some reason? I mean, I know what it is, but I'm just curious.
Well, no, if I don't give the group the title or the writers of the song, then you're either going to take it as it is for the verbiage, or you're going to go hunt and find out anyway. But I didn't want the song itself to be the influence beyond the words.
Right, right. You didn't want the title of – you didn't want people writing – you know, about the group, and you didn't want people writing just the title of the song. You want them to delve into the lyrics.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Very cool. Awesome. All right, well, I'm definitely looking forward to that show. Should be a great one. And I'm going to go ahead now and welcome Victoria. Hello, Victoria. Glad you could join us. How's it going?
Hello.
It's good. How are you guys?
Alrighty.
Oh, I'm doing great.
Good. I'm just slowly losing my mind, which is appropriate for a seriality show. You know,
there you go.
Life.
There you go. Fun stuff. Exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. No, I really like that we decided to go with Irish serial killers. You, obviously, I'm guessing you either have really good timing or you were listening to
I was not listening, so
it, oh, you
it
were.
Ends up it so, ends up being great timing.
Well, no, it was funny because Rex had posted a poem, and I was like, okay, before I start to read this poem, I just want to say, Victoria, if you're listening, this is the last carryover, and we're going to be moving into seriality. And then Rex goes, actually, we have one more. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, second to last. So we're talking. And then we got done with the last carryover, and I was like, okay, Rex, now I want to fill some time in case, you know, Victoria's listening and, you know, give her time to call in. So tell us about your contest. And basically,
I was wondering,
you might be listening.
No, I was legitimately wondering because I call in finally and I hear you guys talking right at the tail end of Rex's contest and what he's looking for. And I'm like, did I miss the show? Like, I was like, I don't think I'm that late. So I'm slowly losing my mind.
Oh my gosh, too funny. Yeah, that's trippy. But no, that was just, I figured it twofold. You know, first of all, it killed a little time. And second of all, I mean, who's really listening by the end of the show? Sometimes, you know, when I'm having Rex promote his Sunday show, the show has already gone off air. You know, and if I did it in the middle of the show, we're more likely to have people hear it. And he'll get right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, let's continue on with this dark party. What do you got for us next, Rex?
My Jolly Jane by Kay Heartless. And since, Victoria, you're fresh in the room, you get the lovely one of this.
Awesome. All right. My Jolly Jane by Kay Heartless. Lay down with me, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane. Erotic shock. It's not that strange. Caressing charges dull the pain, a spoonful more of medicine. Again, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane, stitch us up, we don't behave. Kiss and commas dull the pain, a spoonful more of medicine. Enduring Italian maid, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane, name swap to regal toppin, lying with the dying, dull the pain, a spoonful more of medicine. Too wide a girth to make a gain, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane. Morphine mixed with atropine, stating death, dulls the pain, a spoonful more of medicine. Feeble men don't behave, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane. breathe more shallow than a grave. Stretch in high tide holds the pain, a spoonful more of medicine. At the trial, her refrain, don't you want me? I can clean. Look at all the love I bring. If only I had a wedding ring, I'd never have done these awful things. End poem. Oh, that one gave me goosebumps.
Right? Oh, my goodness. Yeah, great read there, Victoria, and just an amazing dark write by Kay Hartless. And she wrote was inspired by the serial killer Jane Toppin, who was technically an American serial killer, but I counted her in the list of Irish serial killers only because she was first-generation American. Her parents had come over on a boat from Ireland. And surprisingly, there isn't a whole lot of Irish serial killers on record compared to other countries. Now, and my theory is that it's either because they're too drunk to kill people or they're really damn smart and not getting as caught as much as the rest of us. I'm not sure which, but it's one of those two. But yeah, no, I was really impressed with this write, and I am going to comment further. But first, Rex, let's hear your thoughts.
She's an angel of death. She was a nurse at one point, so I kind of gives you the idea of what to use, when to use it, how much to use. So, and Kay plays out the whole nine yards: the needles, the strychnine, the morphine, the mixing. She's got that motive within her, the angel of death. It's I'm doing good. I'm helping these people pass on because they are in such pain, and they are of that point in life where they're of no use to anyone, let alone themselves. So I just help them on their way, so to speak. I do like the ending here. Don't you want me? I can clean. Look at all the love I bring. If only I had a wedding ring, I'd never have done these awful things. Well, yeah, I doubt that very much. You just have found a home and hearth to commit your murders. Like the little old ladies in, Arsenic and Old Lace.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Great observations there, Rex. Yeah, it does remind me kind of the movie Arsenic and Old Lace. But I like that you brought up the angel of death because she's an interesting one. I highly recommend that people who don't know about her read about her because some people consider her an angel of death while others do not. She did go to school and for nursing and was a nurse. However, if you read about her, she was actually quoted as saying that her ambition was to have killed more people, helpless people, than any other man or woman who ever lived. It was also said that she confessed to getting a sexual pleasure from lying next to her patient or laying next to them while they were dying or while they were dead. So there's kind of on one hand, she was considered an angel of mercy because of being in the medical field and because of, you know, attacking people who were under her care or killing people under her care. But at the other time, there's certain aspects of an angel of mercy style serial killer that's missing within her motives.
Not angel of mercy, just an angel of death with a God complex.
Okay. That's the angel of mercy, the other one. Yeah, you're right. Okay, my bad. I was putting the two of them together, so yeah. Oh, but yet it says here that she's often considered an angel of mercy in the actual article about her. But I would, as I guess I just said, disagree that she wasn't an angel of mercy, but rather a egotistical sexual predator. Now, as for Kay's right, I love that she had the repetitive lines, a sing-song type voice to this. My Jolly Jane, my Jolly Dane, name swap to regal, toppin', lying with the dying, dolls of pain, a spoonful more of medicine. And a spoonful more of medicine, it's kind of like that whole Mary Poppins type feel to that. You know, and the sing-song of this really adds to the darkness. Kisses and comas, dolls the pain, and the whole idea of don't you want me, I can clean, look at the love I bring. You know, the whole idea of you can be my savior, you can make me a better person, when there was never, ever any intention of being a better person. I think Kay did an amazing job with this. I think Jolly Jane is a particularly, I mean, all serial killers obviously are dark, but there's something particularly dark about her demeanor and her story. I'm glad Kay was inspired. And Victoria, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
So I really love what you were talking about when you were talking about what kind of motivates an angel of death or an angel of mercy. And Jane Toppin was known as the angel of death. But there is that criminology behind it, the angel of mercy, the angel of death. They're kind of viewed as intermingling. And if you look at the criminology psychology of an angel of mercy or an angel of death, they're usually in the medical field. That's where they are. The mercy killer tends to believe that the victims are suffering or beyond help. They are sadistic in the idea that they are exerting their power and control over helpless victims. And then they're also called the malignant hero. And we see this in actually a few different angel of death or angel of mercy serial killers, where they don't actually mean to kill the people, but they want to be the person that saves them from death. And sometimes those patients just overdose. So that malignant hero kind of gives and takes. Like all serial killers, no one fits into a perfect mold. They just have similar traits. What I find interesting about Jane is that, like you were saying, Pam, she wasn't really interested in saving her patients. In fact, the article about her very clearly says that she picked her, and I'm going to read off of it, Toppin became close with the patients. She picked her favorite ones. The patients were normally elderly and very sick. During her residency, Toppin used her patients as guinea pigs in experiments with morphine and atropine. She altered their prescribed dosages to see what it did to their nervous system. However, she spent considerable time alone with the patients, making up fake charts and medicating them to drift in and out of consciousness and even getting into bed with them. She wasn't trying to give them mercy. She wasn't there to save them. They were legitimately nothing more than a guinea pig to see what effects these things have, how much is too much, and exerting that control. In that case, she is an angel of death because her whole intent was to control, to cause death, to see where too much was too much. None of this was about mercy. There's always the excuse, well, they were sick, they were old, but none of it was really about mercy for her. And like you said, she wanted to kill more. She wanted to do it sneakily. She didn't really care if they survived or if they didn't. And it was exciting to her in more ways than one for her to do these things to them. So for that, it's horrifying. And then, of course, this poem, like you said, it has that sing-song, almost children's rhyme quality to it, which, you know, children's rhymes are horrific things. They have such dark, dark backstories. And this falls into it, like you were saying, my Jolly Jane, my Jolly Jane, you know, another spoonful of medicine, which actually reminds me very much of Mary Poppins, you know, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Here is this woman who's saying, oh, just a spoonful of medicine. And of course, I'm trusting her because of her position, having that power, not really the malignant hero, not really there to give mercy, but still we see that sadism. So I thought that this was really quite stunning. It's a hard one to read because it seems so happy, it seems so bright, but really we're talking about ultimately someone who took life and crushed it with their fingers, always having the excuse, always having a reason. And just like Rex said, even if they had been married, even if they had, if she had found love, more than likely it would not have changed her behavior. And it probably just would have added another victim to her docket that we would later be exhuming, like Aunt Dottie, who murdered several of her husbands. So I thought that this was marvelous. I love the consistency and the rhyme of it. I love the vibrancy of it, the almost playful nature of it, all the while masking the horror of what we're really talking about. It was really, really well done with a fantastic topic.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I really liked your comment. I particularly liked that you brought up that one part about how she experimented with her patients that were in comas. It very much made me think of this video I watched on the female soldiers, employees, whatever you would have called them, that were in the Nazi concentration camps. And how there was this one, and I can't remember her name, but she was known for being particularly evil. It had that feel to it. So I was glad that you brought up that part. Great observations there. And all right. What do you got for us next, Rex?
Dr. Deep Sleep by Incubus 2. He prescribed a good long rest. Deep sleep, he said, was preferable to opiates when the fever wouldn't break. So sent them deep within the realms of his self-induced unconsciousness from which they were never to awaken. Comatose conundrum, easily mistaken for simply sleeping sickness, but those were not insect bites. They were the treacherous telltale signs of unprescribed, unrequired hypodermic injections. Firstly forged in fraudulent financial gain, acquired through duress and eloquently spoken words, he bled them dry without ever owning a scalpel and bone.
Great read there, Rex, and a wonderful dark right by Incubus 2, who was inspired by, John Botkin Adams, who actually wasn't technically ever proven to be a serial killer, but obviously, as we'll probably discuss, there was very suspicious circumstances. He actually was never convicted of being a serial killer, so he's put as a suspected serial killer. Victoria, let's hear your thoughts. Yeah.
Well, he only had 163.
Yep.
Well, there was another one back then, too, another GP, one Harold Shipman, who was put away in 2000 for something like 218, maybe 250 killing his patients. So between the two of them, they did a hell of a job killing off their patients.
Right? No kidding. No kidding. And, yeah, it's crazy. Like you mentioned the numbers, Rex, and the numbers are crazy that 163 of his patients died while in comas. And out of that, like 132 out of 310 had left him money or items in their wills. I'm glad you brought up those numbers.
He's a country doctor. He needs a few shekels and shillings to get by because he's got a living to make.
Oh, right. Absolutely. He's got to continue to do his good work.
Hey, it's hard work making all these people disappear by just giving them a little shot. Hey, a long rest into the big sleep. Dr. Deep.
Exactly. Yeah. I have to agree. And what do you think, Victoria?
So you guys kind of stole my whole comment right there, but I found it really interesting because, you know, the poem plays on not just the life that he took, but also the way that he weaseled himself into wills. And that's one of the things that I really wanted to delve deeper into and just didn't have the time to research before the show is, like you guys were saying, he was in 132 wills of his patients. Why? I mean, more than likely, when he first started caring for these people, he wasn't in the will. And the history of wills, usually a person who's under this kind of care is not allowed to adjust their will because there could be duress, there could be force involved, there could be incapacitation. So you have someone who needs this medical care of a doctor coming in, and suddenly, magically, this doctor is included in their will. Now, it doesn't really go into how much he received. It's just that little overview of something. But it really does call into question, how did this happen? You know, how did he get into these wills? Why did he get into these wills? And I think that Incubus really beautifully tied that in with the idea of first forged of fraudulent financial gain, acquired through duress and eloquently spoken words. He bled them dry without ever owning a soul. He took from them throughout their life before he ever, and then probably took from their estate. I thought that this was really brilliant for playing on the idea of John Bodkin. I don't remember her name off the top of my head, but there was another woman who did something very similar to this, where she was, there's a Netflix series called The Worst Roommate Ever. And it talks about a woman who opened her home to homeless people, and they ended up excavating dozens of bodies. She was actually poisoning people and burying them in her yard. And the downfall of her was that she did this to a person who was being watched by social services. He was a recovering alcoholic, a homeless man. I'll have to remember her name. But she did the same thing. She presented herself as a nurse and was actually giving people medication to paralyze them, knock them unconscious, and then she would steal from them, and it developed into finally murder. And this really reminds me of that. He, of course, came before this other woman, just barely. Her arrest was in the 1980s. He obviously was more along the 1950s, so he's 30 years or senior at least. But we see this use of medicine, this trusted physician, especially when it wasn't regulated the way that it is today. It was not long ago that you could buy opiates without being a doctor, where they could be stored in a hospital without being locked up. And so part of all these things, John Bodkin, this other woman, all added into the medical industry being controlled and controlled substances that we now have today and that restriction to it. But I thought that this was a marvelous piece. I think he's such an interesting character just because of the way that he weaseled into people's lives far more than just stealing them while medicating them. You know, he got into those estates and managed to take from the family even after the person was dead. Really quite a fantastic topic and great poem that he got there.
Absolutely. And I really like that. That was a wonderful comment. And I liked that you went into how the law works. And, you know, it's interesting because I would guess, obviously I don't know, but I would guess that laws about wills and not being able to change them in such conditions would have to do with the fact that probably came into practice, probably were written up after, because of cases like this, You know, I'm guessing that perhaps the time that he was, getting on into people's wills, that there wasn't necessarily such laws or put into place, or if there was, maybe he just knew the right people to victimize. I also, as you were commenting, and it felt like in your comment, what I interpreted part of it as is that idea, and what I see within him is the idea of someone who really has that narcissistic personality, really is able to, charm people when he can, even to the point, as you mentioned, having the family agree to let him take the money and or the gifts given. So great comments there and observations, Victoria. And before we continue on, I'd like to welcome a turkey to the show. Welcome, Jeremy.
Gobble, gobble.
Glad you could join us. How's it going?
Hi, guys. That's going great. Great to be here. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, no worries. Better late than never.
That's right.
Yep. And Rex, your thoughts on this, right?
Wait a minute. I thought I was the first one, wasn't I?
I thought you were
being
funny.
Yeah, I was. The first comment, Rex.
You were still okay. See, I thought.
Well, the funny part is he was never convicted of murder, and the whole thing back then was what, 1956, 57. You're looking just after the war, and the fact that a lot of people back then, probably his older patients, didn't have anybody left because of the war itself, having taken so many lives. So did he do some untoward things? Yeah, probably. Was he guilty of being maybe naive in some requirements? Yes. And did he give large doses of opiates? Yes, but he said he didn't murder. So it was never proven one way or the other, and he was found not guilty, I believe.
Yes. The only thing he was ever found guilty of was fraud. You're right about that. He was found not guilty,
He was a greedy bastard in the waning days of the 50s, taking what he could.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And it is, and you know what? I'm glad you brought that up, Rex. And had I known that you were stealing the first comment, I may have actually let you actually say more. But I really like that you brought up the idea that, because that he was said to be the innocent, like he was, And that there's, but your comment made me think about how that the idea that some people say that because the system was faulty, he was found innocent. And then there's others who say because the system was faulty, vice versa, he lost, his good reputation. But interestingly enough, here's one of his quotes. Adams was first tested on November 24th, this is his quote, well, leading up to it, November 24th, 1956, on 13 charges, including false representation on cremation certificates and granted bail. He was arrested on December 19th, 1956, and charged with the murder of Mrs. Morrill. When told of the charges, he said, murder, can you prove it was murder? I didn't think you could prove it was murder. She was dying in any event. So there's definitely, it's intriguing to look at both sides of the coin and the idea of in which way did the legal system fail as far as this particular case. So I'm glad you brought that up, Rex. Great comment there. And Jeremy, your thoughts on this poem?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a step behind on this one. I love Incubus's stuff, but I missed most of the poem because I was too busy playing with turkey emojis. So I think you guys have done a great review of it so far. I've just been enjoying listening, but I'm ready for the next one. I'm ready to engage with you guys.
All right. Very cool. What do you got for us next, Rex?
Flypaper Tea by Babla. That one's yours.
All right. Flypaper Tea by Babla, and it goes like this. A sticky thing, those bills that pile up, sheet upon sheet, pulling at pocket strings, buzzing and buzzing. The callers are calling, asking for things, an arm and a leg, whole body at alms, rubbing together, coated in scratch, one less mouth to feed, one less palm to grease. The math is simple to me. A bit of flypaper tea stewed in a pot, sipped with supper and traded for a spot. The blowflies are humming and stroking their wings, clinging to bodies, whispering hymns. Who'd have thought the carcass not rot? Hush now, hush, how loudly they speak, dead men who talk. End poem. And Babbler wrote to prompt number 7, which was, I actually have to look at the, I think it was
two women.
The last. Yes, it was Catherine Flanagan and Margaret Higgins, who were actually sisters, and they were known as the Black Widows of Liverpool. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Bill collectors are the worst, and I mean, it's kind of a fitting end. It's morbid as the tale is of filling someone with poison and killing them. But yeah, what caught me was the beginning of this, and I'm kind of actually cheering for the villain, which is a cool way to make you approach a poem. One of the most freeing things that we had in our lives is when we left the U.S. and lived abroad for a while, and the bill collectors couldn't chase us down because all you have to do is turn off your Skype on your computer and there's no way they can ever find you. So knowing that being hounded over stuff is absolutely the worst, and I love how there's just kind of a nursery rhyme, almost like a Hansel and Gretel feel to this, of coming in and drinking the stew, and again, it's a weird thing to cheer for the villain, but sometimes, it just feels justified. Very cool poem by Babbler.
Yes, absolutely, and you're right. Sometimes we want to cheer for the victims, and these particular sisters were landlords that lived in Liverpool, England, but they were born and grew up in Ireland, and they were convicted of actually only one murder, which was a poisoning, and was done for the insurance money, for the payout that they got, the insurance money, and so your comment there, Jeremy, really makes me think about the whole idea of what do we see as justification for murder and what do we not see as justification. And they had four alleged victims, but were only convicted of one. And I believe that one was a child, if I remember right. I know at least one of their eight-year-old, an eight-year-old child. The one person that they got convicted for was actually their brother or something. I don't know. I'm trying to read it here. But anyways, great comment there. And Rex, your thoughts?
Oh, two things. Using this is
uh-huh.
the flypaper tea is quite the angle of seeping out the arsenic from the flypaper to make tea with. That's a hell of a thing to do, but that kind of and the way it's done kind of walks that note of the arsenic and old lace because it's two ladies doing this. But the other angle is, this was done purely for profit. It runs off that notion of getting the person to take out a life insurance policy with their names on it and then going about their business of brewing tea upon tea and slowly killing the person until they finally keel over. And most times they'd get away with it. I mean, Over here, the mafia was doing that in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. They'd run that this very same scam. It's an easy one. They put up the money for the insurance angle, get the person to and then go out and kill him. Usually accidental, having him run over by a car or drowning or something. But it was a great way of making money easily because people were really expendable and nobody was paying attention to what's going on because nobody was thinking about these things except the very few people who were looking for easier ways to make a living.
Absolutely, absolutely. The great comment there, Rex. I really like how you brought up the flypaper thing. I didn't actually know that, so very cool. Very cool. Always cool to learn a new and interesting fact, and that makes that a very...
Fact check.
I'm on it.
Yep. Go to provetherex.com. And check that out. great comment there, Rex. And you're right. And what particularly struck me about your comment was that you touched on the idea of how people too oftentimes see other people as dispensable. There's a real lack of value for human life. So I thought that was a great comment. I really liked how you mentioned that, and then the idea of profiting from the payout. So excellent comment. And Victoria, your thoughts?
So Rex is right. Early 19th or 19th century and early 20th century society was very casual about the use of arsenic, and so it was in flypaper. So I can validate Rex on that. But one thing that I really find interesting is that often, and this is kind of where these women stand alone, not really alone, but kind of in their own little area. Usually when we see historically when we see women killed, they use poison. And typically their motivation is not for profit. It is more common for a male serial killer to use murder as a way to get profit. We see those life insurance policies typically with the men. We see those deeper motivations. Often, and I think of Aqua Tofana, it was a woman who was poisoning her husband to get out of the marriage. But nothing that these women were doing was to get out of the marriage. It was all about the burial societies of their time. It was about making those that money. And when you think about it, yeah, there's, of course, inflation that's happened since the 1800s when this was going on, but they did it for 100 pounds, which is just, we're not talking millions and millions of dollars there. Even with inflation, we're not talking millions of dollars. We're talking like thousands, maybe tens of thousands at best, but we're really not talking a ton of money when it comes to this. And yet it was enough motivation for these women to do that. And even after they were caught, that's when the confessions came out. Where was it? I was just reading, I think it's in the aftermath. At the time of the arrest, Catherine claimed to her solicitor that the murders were not isolated and provided a list of 6 or 7 other deaths that she claimed to be killings related to burial society fraud, as well as a list of 5 other women who had either perpetrated those murders or provided insurance to those who did. So it was a whole thing that was doing this, which is not what we typically think. And the fact that these women, these two women, are the ones that were remembered, even though there may even have been a whole ingrained society that was involved in this, is kind of shocking. We often don't want to think that society could be so pitted against each other, could be so well threaded or infiltrated with evil. But one of the jokes that I've had is that divorce is not getting more common in society. As much as we are like, oh, the divorce rate is like 50% common in our society. Murder is just more easily to discover. And I think that in many ways, these women kind of point to that. So many things went unseen, went unheard. And there are so many women who probably help perpetuate some of these things, or other people who help perpetuate these things for their personal gain and not for the benefit of society. So it's a marvelous, marvelous poem. Babbler always does such a fantastic job with pulling these together. It does not leave the feel of these women, and more so the psychopathy of someone who would do something that they did, which I think is just fantastic. But it also leaves that burning question of how many were there actually partaking in this that we just glossed over because of the horror that would mean admitting.
You're right, because back then, insurance policies, you didn't take out big ones because that was a big question mark with the company. Why are you taking out so much? And that one I was thinking about with the Chicago one was a drunk who'd come into the into a particular mob bar all the time, and they owed him money, so they paid up his insurance, and then went about trying to kill him with grain alcohol, except they didn't know that after drinking all that grain alcohol, he was such a lush that he'd still drink more, and he'd pass out. They'd think he was dead. He'd wake up and go right back to the bar. Didn't realize that you can drink grain alcohol like that, yes, but once you gave him a shot of regular alcohol, it dissipates and neutralizes all the grain alcohol that he's drunk. So they spent more money pouring this shit down him than they actually got out of the insurance claim that they put in for him.
Oh, wow.
Well, and that's exactly it, though, is that there was such a lack of understanding for how things actually work together. There was such a lack of understanding of, you know, of due diligence, of investigation. And I do think, again, talking about how these historical events have influenced our current day world and life, you know, we have now insurance policies that if you take any out and anything happens to you, they investigate it. You know, but
yep.
Back then, for whatever reason, they were just like, the guy died. It seems reasonable enough. We're going to move on. There wasn't an autopsy that was even performed on her first husband, on Catherine's husband. The brother is the one who said, but he was a really strong guy. Why did he succumb to this? And it was only at his behest was the husband exhumed, and an autopsy was done, causing Catherine to flee. So I think that it's really quite interesting because, again, we get to see how this society has impacted our current world. And yeah, we think it's logical. Yeah, of course, if there's a questionable death, you know, of course insurance is going to look into it. Of course they're going to do their due diligence. Of course all of this makes sense, as if it's always been happening, but it really hasn't always been happening. So, yeah.
Great comments. Yeah, I really liked this poem by Babbler. The title was clever. You know, I like how it goes into that idea of selling body parts for the payout. And I like, Victoria, that you brought up the conspiracy, the alleged conspiracy of other women being involved, which, like, as you mentioned, the idea that two women who supposedly killed, you know, at the most five times for very small payouts, it really does make you wonder, make you question, you know, the whole idea of perhaps there was more going on, that perhaps there was, you know, more behind the scenes than, you know, than just them. I particularly like how she brings in, within the last couple of stanzas, the blowflies are humming and stroking their wings, clinging to bodies, whispering hymns. I feel like the blowflies work well as that symbology of death and almost like a metaphor for the sisters themselves, And also how that very last line, how loudly they speak, then men who talk, is a really great nod towards that the fact that that the body was dug back up and then or I don't know if it was dug back up, but it was done an autopsy because, as you said, the brother said, well, why did he succumb to this? Why? What is going on? And so there was an autopsy done, and through that autopsy, they found the evidence of arsenic poisoning. And so I thought that that end line really fit in well with that idea. So an excellent write by Babbler and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
I hear you.
Oh.
Yeah? What do you
have
for us next?
We've got Death's Hand and Logoria by Duncan Ross Bell. And that one's going to go to Jeremy.
Death's Hand and Logoria by Duncan Ross Bell. The verge is the urge, the purge I'm trying to deflect. Affect the sound, insects abound, skin crawling, infects, time stalling effects. The quotes to blasphemy, rhymes aren't the half of me. Lighter flicks shadows in the night, dull eyes and bright scars, shaking hands to pens of twitch, dibs for drabs and token stitch. But, oh, please no. The flow is which is what the show was, the buzz from the brain cell. Hell from the switch flip, tip the hat, quick. Sip the pose, lick the thorns from the rose, bleed in prose. Scan the voice, speak in moments, seek the ability. Serendipity is a word, absurd to think in questions. This thought needs a break. Take a breath. The over is in the dose. There's a sanction to the saying. Plain sight is in the blindness. Tranquility is in the pain. End poem.
Great read there, Jeremy. And Duncan was inspired also by Jane Toppin, otherwise known as Jolly Jane. I really like the rhyme and flow in this poem, just some really clever playing with words and phrases. And Victoria, your thoughts?
I thought that this was really, really well done because Death's Hand and Logoria, so that's someone who has a propensity to talk, someone who's very chatty-cathy kind of. And yet, in all of this, there's kind of this play, this reminder that she had gotten close to people. She made friends, or at least people believed that she was their friend. And yet, in the end of all of it, it was just a way for her to get close enough for them to trust her to not question what she was doing. Because she was doing this in a medical situation. There were other nurses. There were people that were involved in these patients' care besides her that had to be fooled or had to be not given a reason to question. And so it just is, it's just a reminder of the maliciousness that she displayed in getting close to them, in talking to them, in creating the blasphemy of trust and friendship so that these patients would not say, hey, is there a reason that Jane did this? You know, I'm really tired after Jane gave me this medicine, only for a nurse to go, well, that's odd. You shouldn't even be on that. It just shows that malevolence and the depth that she went to, along with the disregard and the sociopathic tendency to dehumanize your victim, because she knew them enough to disarm them so that she could use them for her own gain. And that's just horrifying. And I think Duncan really captured that really, really well.
I have to agree with you. And I like that you brought up her charm, how she had this ability to charm people. And if not the whole time, at least, you know, in that first meeting and for enough for there to be that sense of trust. Really great observations there, Victoria, about her personality and how she was able to make people see something that wasn't there. Rex, your thoughts.
Well, it's all in the sound. End quotes to blasphemy. The rhymes aren't half of me. The flow is what the show was. Buzz from the brain cell. Health from the switch flip. Tip the hat. Quick. Sip the pose. Lick the thorns from the rose. Lead in prose. Scan the voice. And then that I like that back, the last four lines. The over is in the dose. There's a sanction for the stain. Plain sight is in the blindness. Tranquility is in the pain. A nice choice at offering up the back end with a little play on the words itself, plus a little bit of insight to the person. Offering up the notion of sanction in the stain and plain sight, everything being in plain sight is in the blindness, but nobody's really seeing what's going on anyway. And tranquility is in the pain, that which is delivered and that which is felt.
Yeah, I have to agree. I like that you brought up that last stanza, because there is some really great wordplay in there, especially in that line, the over is in the dose. You know, and I like also, I'm glad you brought up that third stanza, which the full is what the show was, Buzz from the Brain Cell. Was that the one I was thinking of? No. That was, although that one was also a good one. The one that I found, where is that? The line about the rhyme. Where is that?
Second stanza? Third stanza.
Third, it is the third stanza. Okay. Because, you know,
second
I
line
really
in the
felt...
Second line in the second?
Yes. That's it. Thank you, Jeremy. Okay. Yeah. End quotes to blasphemy. Rhymes aren't the half of me. Lighter flick shadows in the night. What I found, what caught my attention about that was I felt like Duncan was writing about himself and the serial killer at the same time. You know, like I felt like in that part he's saying, you know, I'm more than just the rhymes. There's a deeper message. But it also conveys to me the idea, you know, of there's more to me than this gentle demeanor, this giggly voice, this charm, you know, that whole Jolly Jane demeanor. There is a deeper and darker person within me, as a nod towards Jolly Jane herself. And I don't know how, but that thought didn't come to me until when I was listening to Rex's comment. You know, so that's how somehow I got down that rabbit trail. But really great observations there, Rex. Great comment. And Jeremy, you read that. Great. Your thoughts?
Yeah, great comments, guys. And I like hearing the history about what the story and what the prompt is for this, because I feel like this poem kind of reflects a lot of that story and how that experience would be. First of all, I love poetry like this that has so much wordplay, especially when the phonics of all of it and the bulk and the body of this poem does that. And it's a fun trip to read through and spend more than one or two reads doing exactly that, especially when you discover new things like what Pam just experienced. I think it's cool to find the plays that obviously Duncan has the ability to put more thought behind just making things sound funny. He also has deliberate moves in that funny phonic sound. But what I was saying in the beginning is the experience and the history of what prompted this poem kind of happens in this, because all the wordplay that happens in the first four stanzas, and then you have that pause with take a break, and then it's a lot about what Victoria was saying at the very beginning about how it's Liguria and the talk and the romance of bringing someone in, and then you take a breath with that single line, and then you go to the final, and the wordplay is still there, but it takes a different meaning. It goes with the anonyms, and that was never done, or at least not as obvious in the rest of the book. The poem was more about how the word sound, and there was a lot of more homonyms, and then when you go to the anonyms at the end, and it's still having the wordplay, but it's a different feel. It's like the deed has been done, or it's about to be done. It's the ending of the life. You're finally going to that next stage of what the whole point of it was. So it was the dance of the spider attracting the fly. She catches him, and then she kills him at the end. So I think there's kind of a parallel to that is what I picked up on. Very great write by Duncan, though. I enjoyed it on several levels, and you guys had great analysis of it as well.
Absolutely. Great comment there. I have to agree. Nicely layered write. And Rex, what do you got for us next?
My Doppelganger and Me by Truth Chills. And Victoria, this one's for you.
Thank you, Rex. My Doppelganger and Me by Truth Chills. Oh, how names can be deceiving while wicked webs are weaving. Jolly Jane, my given nickname, perfect cover for a murderess on a mission to be America's number one serial killer. My ultimate ambition. I hid behind misguided assumptions that little old me could never be the one. I'm just a feeble-minded woman. So you, my peers, made your ignorance my accomplice year after year. In the beginning, I was plagued with deranged fantasies and prophetic dreams, wishing I could find a perfect way to kill somebody and not get caught. I was in this for the long haul. Inspired by my crazy father who sat night after night, whispering insanities into my subconscious mind, planting twisted, hateful things. I believe like a spider lays eggs, so did my father in my head, only to be activated later by the evil, inherited entities that later became demonic mentors to me, abandoned to a dark place, a place for orphan little girls. A place perfect for evil to take hold and convert an already weakened soul. A place where my mind was continuously raped night after night until I was no longer and we became my doppelganger. Along came a widow not out of pity or love but convenience. Took me home to be her slave on the hopes that she may or may not pay me someday. My mind was silenced to a dull roar for a few years, but no more. Mrs. Toppin died not leaving much. Now I worked for my so-called sister. Oh, how I despised her. When she met her a mister and no doubt, for all my hard work, she left me a 50 greenback tea, sneered at me saying, "You're lucky you get anything." For that, among many things, I made her a victim, a distant memory. My next step, I joined Cambridge College and took nursing, salivating, waiting for the moment those eggs in my head would finally give birth and manifest the evil that lurks. Oh, my, as said the we in me, let's see if we could set some of those old folks free and gain the title Angel of Mercy. But we all know that the devil's plan is to steal, kill, and destroy mankind. But murder is not enough. He has to humiliate and disgrace us. I got to choose the weapon of choice, so I chose to watch them go slow and then bring them back to life two or three times. I learned the exact regimen between morphing and whatever I had on hand, mixing one with the other to the right dose. And now, weapon complete, I began my killing spree. I am the greatest master of disguise, killed more than any man or woman alive, thanks to my doppelganger mission complete and full.
Wonderful read there, Victoria. I really like this write by Truth Chills. You know, first of all, I like that she chose doing the first-person voice, taking on the voice of Jolly Jane. Jane Toppin was obviously our most chosen prompt. People were really inspired and intrigued by her. I liked how the attention to detail that she goes into. One of the things she brought up, which really hadn't been brought up in any of the other writes, the mention of the father, of Jane's father, and which brings up the idea of her childhood, because Jane, who was actually her first name was actually Honoria, her middle name was Jane. Her mother died when she was young, and her father, Peter Kelly, was known as an eccentric and abusive alcoholic, nicknamed by those who knew him as Kelly the Crack. There were actually several local rumors regarding his insanity, the most popular one being that his madness finally drove him to sew his own eyelids closed while working as a tailor. Now, while I highly doubt that story, there is always a little bit of truth behind every story, and the guy obviously was insane. Now, when Jane was a child, her father put her and one of her sisters into a Boston female asylum, an orphanage for indigent female children. And surprisingly, the one sister who did not get taken away from the father, well, actually probably not surprisingly, was the one who grew up to be, and became committed to an insane asylum. So the reason I bring that up and the reason I like that this right and that Truth Chills mentions the father is because I think it brings us into the realm of how much does the circumstance of somebody's childhood affect their psychology and affect the outcome of whether or not they will become a serial killer. I just think this is an absolutely excellent dark right and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
I think you just hit most of it. Truth actually dug quite a bit into the back angle of this to prove, well, not just prove that, to hit on the thoughts of maybe what Jolly Jane would offer up herself, murderous on a mission, America's number one serial killer, my ultimate ambition. And then the thought of the progression, and even so to sit there and blame everybody else for who and what she became, even though it was her who had always endeared a good portion of this thought and idealization herself. Back end with the father was a nice touch. I like the spider. I believe like a spider lays eggs, so did my father in my head, only to be activated later. And she took that to heart as something for her to be known as and embraced it wholeheartedly. So the I becoming no longer and we becoming a singular kind of hits on that notion of schizophrenia, but I don't think she was schizophrenic. It's just an easy way of putting across the two sides of a singular coin, one evil and one maybe not nearly as evil as the other side, but dutifully raw as the back end goes, because she does kill her sister there, and all over a $50 bit, which was that was quite a bit of money back then. And then looking for that title, Angel of Mercy, but the back end of this, she hits on that thought, the devil gets his due. It doesn't matter what it is. And the fact that she chose to go with that route with the bringing it back two or three times, so there's some real glee and enjoyment in the kill, then bringing him back so she can kill him again.
Absolutely. Yeah, great comment there, Rex. I do like that you brought up the fact that, that it stands about, you know, bringing them back to life so she could kill them again. And the two sides to the coin, the much eviler side than the other. So great observations there. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, first of all, excellent read, Victoria. I think you really got into the spirit of this, and it was a joy to hear you perform this poem. I think you did an excellent job. And going through it, and it was helpful to have Pam fill in with a lot of the history of this as well. But I think Truth Chills really kind of told the story in a great way in a prose format, and I wasn't lost on the poetic form or the poetic spirit of it, given all of those challenges, being that it was, again, in a prose form, and there was so much storied history to the poem. I still felt entertained by the art of what was presented. And I thought the best part of this, too, was that, again, I found myself conflicted. I found myself conflicted on whether or not I want to cheer for
for the villain, or if I want to, or if she was actually the ultimate victim that was a, you know, her actions were a result of what you guys talked about earlier, her harsh upbringing. And I even felt that way after what I found to be one of the most punctual sentences in the whole poem right from the beginning. It says, "So you, my peers, made your ignorance my accomplice year after year." She's calling us all stupid right out of the gate. And I'm still cheering for her because she had such a tough upbringing and she was a victim of her own circumstances. So it's an evil poem, and I don't know. I thought it was very well composed, and I like the fact that I believe that it was Pam also said that it was from the first person, but yet there's the doppelganger. There's that someone else to blame, like what Rex had just said. There's always someone else that she's pointing the finger at as being the reason for the awful actions. Cool, right?
Absolutely.
Jeremy, I just have to say, I think that's a marvelous comment that you just provided. And it actually reminds me of a conversation, if I might steal a little bit of time. It reminds me of a conversation of at what point do we allow our past to be an excuse for bad behavior? Because there are people who have been through horrific things, who turn out to be some of the most caring, kind, and positive people that you can be around. And then you have other people who grow up in relative wealth and cushiness and had a want for naught, and they can be some of the most horrendous people. In fact, there's one serial killer, it's a woman, who had no issues with her childhood, and she was just horrific. Anna, there's another show on Netflix, Inventing Anna, and it talks about Anna Delvey, who actually grew up in, she grew up in a good home. She grew up in an environment where the parents cared, and yet she's the one who perpetrated massive fraud, financial fraud, against the socialites in New York. So it calls the question, does our childhood justify our current behavior? And at what point do we have to take ownership of our own actions, or do we get to continue to say, well, there's this horrific thing that happened to me, and it shaped me to be this way? Is it truly an excuse, or is it just a way to try and make yourself seem not so bad once your sins are exposed? So I liked your comment because it kind of plays that philosophical idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great comments, both of you. And yeah, you're right, Victoria. Definitely does delve into a whole idea of how much does our past excuse us or our current behavior. So great comments there. And Victoria, was there anything else that you wanted to say about the right before we continue on?
No, I just think that this was really a marvelous right. You know, it's always, I love this show because we don't just look at the serial killers. Often there's this delve into the psychology behind it. And I know that we've had a couple in the past where people really got into the mind of the murderer. But what I think was really marvelous about this piece was to play with a doppelganger. If you know the mythos behind the idea of a doppelganger, it's actually a way to predict your own death. And yet, being used more like an alter ego. It wasn't a demon, or it is in this case being treated as a demon, who is guiding her on her way to become the person that she is. Whereas, again, typically, if you see your doppelganger, you have this finality. I recently was listening to a podcast, actually, about Abraham Lincoln, and it's documented that Abraham Lincoln had a few dreams prior to his assassination that kind of foreshadowed that, and one of them actually involved the doppelganger. He was awake, according to the dictated history, that he was awake and he had laid down in his bed and he saw two reflections of himself in the mirror beside his bed. The first one was a perfect doppelganger and the second one was him who looked pale and dead. And he sat up, sat back down, same thing, and went to his wife and told his wife. And his wife said, "I believe that you will have two terms, and you will die on your second one. And that's what happened. And there's multiple stories. Even his last conversation with his mother-in-law, she hugged him farewell and said, I will never see you again, long before there was anything that was going on. So doppelgangers is the history of them is malevolent, but not for other people. So I thought that it was really intriguing that in this piece, that was the chosen medium to show that darkness. I thought that was really fascinating that it was almost befriending your doppelganger, because again, it's this malevolent spirit that foretells of bad omens. But it was never her bad omen. It was everybody else's. I really enjoyed the experimentation that was showed there. Again, that malicious heroism of making sure that they didn't die, so that she could come and salvage them, bringing them back two or three times to continue the experimentation. And it may not have been a heroic act that she was trying to get to save them, but more so the experiment of how much is too much? How much can I give before they are unable to be revived? How much? And those experiments to get that perfect drug, to get that perfect mix, to see what can be combined with what. It shows a fantastic mind, and I think that she really delves into the mind of the serial killer, into the psychology of it. But it really is all about delving into that mind and understanding where it would come from, the glee of fine-tuning your weapon of choice, the joy of successfully saying, oh, nope, I can go this far, and there might not be consequences. I can incapacitate them. And what does this mean? But also, what speaks so profoundly in this piece is that there is no shame in it. There is no humility. There is no guilt. There is pride throughout the entire tone of this piece, at least in my interpretation of it. There's pride throughout this entire thing. There is this pleasure of herself in doing the things the way that she did. And I did enjoy the subtle rhyming throughout the piece, not always consistent, but more of like those epic rhymes where it catches you every once in a while and pulls your attention into that moment. Because suddenly now we've got a reason to emphasize this with that rhyme. I think that was just a really fantastic use of rhyming in a very subtle way to continue to bring that point across. But this is a story, but it is a crafted story. It wasn't something that just happened, but it is excuses that I can only imagine Jane laid awake at night and said, well, you know, my sister did this. You know, I'm doing this to my sister because of this. You know, when people ask, when people know who I am, the greatest serial killer, they will know that the reason for all of this is because of my sister, because I didn't have love, because people thought I was a feeble woman. There's all those justifications. And you really see, like you were talking about earlier, Pam, that narcissistic personality coming out, because she did craft her story to make people empathize with her. And yet she failed to empathize with every single one of her victims.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, great comment there, Victoria. I like that you touched on the feeling of the sense of pride, the dark pride, and that you brought up the doppelganger and how it really works well as a representation for the true form of evil coming out and being exposed. So great observations there. And Rex, what do you got for us next?
Jolly Lady of the Lethal Lamp by Stan Petrovich. That one's yours.
Me? Okay. All right. Jolly Lady of the Lethal Lamp by Stan Petrovich 1.0. And it goes like this. To explore the dead after creating their rank smell all by herself is lumping sugar in her tea. Oh, how she enjoys fondling and sniffing the pubes of the deceased as she compares her pubes being fragrant as an aromatic rosé wine compared to the suckling pigs oinking from their geriatric rotting crotches. None in the world is sacred as she is. if all were eliminated, then she would endure, outshine the sun, outlive the stars. It is logical that to kill all people is a fine goal to achieve. She would then be wrapped in the finest silk of all the land and proceed in glory to etch her story from Massachusetts to the best nursing facility in your home state. So do remain well. Please stay sound. Or go to the puppet master's strings and flings in Jane's poorly prescribed anger, hell, and poem. And another Stunning Dark Ride. I'm really becoming a fan of Stan Petrovich's poetry. Your last comment, Victoria, you were mentioning, one of your comments, you were mentioning how what you really like about this show is that people really delve into the psychology oftentimes of the serial killers that we offer up as prompts. And I think Stan's poem here is a fine example of this. He really goes into the psychology of Jolly Jane, into the how she sees herself as so much better than everyone else. I really just like the lines, her pew being fragrant as an aromatic rosé wine, you know, even her own smell is better than those of everyone around her. And to the kind of madness that's brought into this. This, again, in this right, where it says, it's logical that still people with a fine goal to achieve, she would be wrapped in the finest silk of all the land and proceed in glory. There's this whole idea that, you know, to me, again, it brings me back to the Nazi Germany, particularly at this time to Hitler and his whole idea that he was going to create this perfect Aryan race of which he didn't meet any of the standards. So, you know, it's the kind of madness of Hitler wanting to create a race that he didn't match up to, and the kind of madness of someone who sees themselves as so perfect that they're the only person who is worthy of living, and yet they are so just horribly imperfect from the fact of, you know, their circumstances in life and so many other personal choices. So really just a stunning dark right and very well done. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree, Pam. I think it really does take, the voice does take you into the mind of the killer. And I think I agree with you that Stan did a great job of taking us there on this one. I took this in two separate parts. There's the shock value in the first three, which kind of hints at necrophilia. It's a really in-your-face, gross, dark feeling to the poem. And it becomes – and there are hints of it. I think you hinted on that in the first line of the third where she describes her own smell as being something better than. And then it becomes even more self-aggrandizing through the rest of the poem where – The voice is saying that this awful deed is all justified because of this self-feeling, this egotistical feeling that she's better than everyone else. And it just needs to happen because on that justification alone. So I really liked how it takes you into that dark feel from the jump, and then it tries to bring it up. But it does it in such a narcissistic way that you can't ever cheer for the voice, but you can't turn away either. It's very enthralling. Cool, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said there. And Victoria, your thoughts?
Well, I love what Jeremy had to say there, especially because there is that idea of being better, of smelling better. And you have to think about this. I mean, of course, someone who's a little bit younger, a little bit more vibrant, is able to wash themselves and take care of the androgynous areas, they're going to have a better scent than someone who maybe has to be helped to someone who has to have help changing maybe an adult diaper. You're talking about someone who is in those last years of their life, those years when we focus on making sure that they are respected, that their age and their life experience is taken care of, that they are honored because they are in a very humbling time of their life. They've been a self-sufficient adult for so long, and they are finally at a point where they need the care of someone else. It's that Benjamin Button cycle of needing to have another person care for you, to clean you, to make sure that you are fed and changed, much like an infant. It's the time of our life that I think we all have this fear of our own, of what do those later years look like? Will I go before I reach incapacity? You know, will I be forgotten sitting in my own filth because you're stuck in a nursing home? It's those fears that I think we all have. And Jane, in those moments, chose to compare herself to them, to fondle their genitals and compare them to her own. These people who she took their life with, she continues to dehumanize them. She continues to desecrate and degrade them by trying to think that there is any comparison of what they are when it comes to their physical organs as compared to hers. And I think that's a really profound thing that Stan chose to focus on, the idea of trimming their pubes, of looking at their geriatric rotting crotches. This whole thing reminds us that the justification, the need to be proven better, the need to be something more, something greater, lauded over your victims as superior. She's going to be, because she's not 90 and in need of personal care. Yet, there's a point of pride in that. There's a point of pride in subjecting these people to them, in giving them lumps of sugar all the while feeding them poison in their veins. It's a profound place in hell that I think such people will find themselves in, perpetrators of these kind of acts. Because it's not just dehumanizing, it's disgraceful. It is horrifying, and there is no justification in the world that makes up for the desecration of the body after she had already destroyed their life in the most profound way. So fantastic, right? It's a hard one to read.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, you're at the back end of closing. You got 60 seconds.
Yeah, but it'll be recorded, so you can leave a comment.
Well, it hits on that note in the opening end of enjoying the aromatics of offalacious aromas first thing in the morning. Hitting on the note of lumping sugar in her tea is a note of pure enjoyment in that, the sweet taste of that victory. As far as the necrophilic tone, it's in this, it is biting because it also hits on the, she's not prepped for normality, so she can easily play and dabble in that angle of things in the moment because, well, she's created it, it's hers, so there's no point in not enjoying the moment. There's some wry humor with that sort of compared to the suckling pigs oinking from their geriatric rotting crotches. Oinking hints at that notion of not being fully audible, as like childlike again, and the suckling pig offers up that notation of being ripe in the moment. They've got the apple in their mouth, time to pop them in the oven and let them be enjoyed. The back end of this hits on that sort of godlike with the finest silk of all the lands and proceed to glory. Hits on that notion of godlike there. And the bottom end, or go to the puppet master strings and flings and Jane's poorly prescribed anger hell, delves to a touch of her childhood and the intervening years, anger and hell. She's got plenty of that, but then again, she's also a forward thinker and is smart enough to cover up plenty of what she does. So she's not stupid, even though she's had pretty much of a hard life. So there is more to her than meets the page itself, because you don't get away with stuff like this for a while without having a high intelligence note and the fact that you work problems out before you hit the perfection to a solution.
Absolutely. And that is really a really good point there, and great comment and great observations about both the poem itself and on Jane Toppin and her intelligence and her personality. That's wonderful. I mean, my goodness, we could have done a whole show just on Jane Toppin and saved the other ones or something. I don't know. But, I have to say I'm so glad people were inspired by this contest and this topic. You all are just amazing. Thank you to Victoria and Rex for co-hosting this with me. I really appreciate you both. Thank you to Jeremy for calling in and joining us. Thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, is listening now, or will be listening later. We truly appreciate you all. Thank you to Fill My Eyes for everything she does in the background. We do have a little bit of carryovers. I'm not sure what show they'll go on, but I'll let people know when I know. Great show, everyone. Thank you. I don't know. Did anybody else want to say anything? I'll take that as a no. Okay. All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.